Monday, June 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, activists angered over President Trump's decision last week to send in the military to control demonstrations say it backfired. While protests have overtaken the narrative of COVID-19, health officials have a message. Also ahead, what the European Union is doing to help African nations prepare for a potential uptick in COVID cases. It's all on today's International Edition. Nearly 2 weeks after an African-American man died in police custody in Minneapolis, Minnesota, protests against racial injustice continued nationwide and in other countries. But the Trump administration disputes the core of the complaints that police brutality, including the death of George Floyd, is a result of systemic racism in the U.S. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
No racist police was one of the chants of protesters this weekend.
The outrage that Americans are feeling today about the death of George Floyd is very real. It's very legitimate.
But appearing on ABC's This Week, acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf challenged the refrain.
I do not think that we have a systemic racism problem with law enforcement officers across this country.
There's always the ghost in the room.
Also on ABC's This Week, Congresswoman Val Demings.
We have been fighting systemic racism in this country for 400 years.
A former police chief, Demings says the nation needs to
hold police accountable,
examine training standards and use of force policies, and who exactly is being hired in law enforcement. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Peaceful protests in Washington, D.C. over the weekend were the largest yet. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, they come amid memorial services for George Floyd in North Carolina and the plans for his funeral this week in Texas.
Washington, D.C. hosted some of the largest anti-racism protests in the country under the watchful eye of local and federal law enforcement, assisted by National Guard troops brought in to quell violence and unrest.
And what we saw over the past week is really a city out of control. And I'm happy to say that over the last several days, we've seen that violence decrease.
Acting U.S. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf attributes the decrease in violence to the increased security presence on the streets of the nation's capital.
So we'll continue to monitor that, and we'll pull back the number of assets that we have in D.C. As that violence decreases.
On Sunday, President Donald Trump said he ordered National Guard troops in D.C. to withdraw, as the violence turned to mostly peaceful protests in recent days. But the role of U.S. troops during unrest has become a hotly debated issue. Retired general and former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, was one of a number of high-profile former military leaders who spoke out against President Trump's desire to increase the presence of U.S. military troops on the streets of American cities.
I thought that given the state of the unrest and the risk that we would put the active duty military in a position where its relationship with the American people would be adversely affected, that I should say something.
Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser sent a letter to President Trump requesting the removal of additional law enforcement and National Guard troops not from Washington, D.C. She believes tactics used by security forces against protesters near the White House before President Trump visited a nearby church last week has contributed to the larger protest gatherings.
What Americans saw was federal police forces tear gassing peaceful Americans, and how they responded made clear to the president that Americans would exercise their First Amendment rights and they would do it peacefully. And what he actually did, as you saw for the remaining days, was turn out more people and more people who were there for peaceful protest.
As large crowds gathered for protests throughout many American cities, mourners from across the country filtered into George Floyd's home state of North Carolina to attend memorial services near the town where he was born. Floyd's family and friends now prepare to say their final goodbyes during funeral services planned later this week in Houston, Texas. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News.
The United States had just reached 100,000 COVID-19 deaths when the outrage over George Floyd's death spilled onto the streets and changed the narrative. But health officials warn that with thousands of people gathering to protest, there could be a new surge of coronavirus cases. Americans have not heard from the coronavirus task force in weeks, and President Trump seems to have look to turn the page in what could be a strategic political decision not to address the issue. This, as some states are seeing the number of infections rise. Joining us to get some insight is Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. Thank you for being with us, Doctor. People are confused about where things stand. Are we still in the midst of a pandemic?
It is not gone away. In my opinion, it is a terrible mistake to ignore the pandemic. Even if we're full of outrage and many Americans want to protest and demonstrate, you can't forget that you have a lethal virus still circulating. Some parts of the United States are going up in rates of infection still. Other parts of the world, like Brazil, Peru, are on fire with the epidemic. There's problems in Mexico. So the virus is here. It has been tamped down in some parts of the world, but not everywhere. And if you don't want to get a blowback, then you're going to have to merge the desire to protest police violence against blacks with prudence. And I think the prudent thing to do is everyone who's protesting should have a mask. Everyone who's protesting should bring their hand sanitizer. They should not hug one another. They shouldn't shake hands. They shouldn't kiss. They should try to be socially distant as much as possible. In other words, I know it's hard to do it in a thousands and thousands of persons marched down the street. You don't want to be having parties or information exchanges after demonstrations. You still want to cut back on being indoors with lots of people. So I do think it is vitally important to protect yourself. And I think it's important to protect the police and National Guard or other military. They should be masked and they should be also practicing good hygiene. Any one of those groups can be the source of a rebound outbreak.
So even though they're outdoors and it's getting warmer out, does the sun, the warmth have any impact? Does the fact that they're outdoors?
Well, the value of being outdoors is very helpful, but it has nothing to do with heat. The viruses are not impacted by warm weather. Italy had plenty of dead people in a warm weather country, so did Iran. What counts when you go outdoors is that you're not normally socially as close to one another as you are when you're indoors. So if you're doing big demonstrations where you're shoulder to shoulder for hour after hour, and you're yelling and screaming in addition to sneezing, then no, I don't think we're going to see a warm weather or an outdoor advantage.
Do you think that we are going to possibly see a whole new surge in the coming weeks because of the protests?
I believe we will see a surge because of the protests in the virus. The good news is that many of the people who are out there are young, and so I'm not sure we're going to get a surge into the hospitals. What I worry about is that they'll get infected and bring it home. We may see flare-ups in older people who are exposed to the people who are out protesting. Similarly with the troops and cops, you have to sort of not just see where they are because they may get infected but tolerate the virus and not show symptoms and so on. But where are they going? Have they brought it back inadvertently to other groups that are much more vulnerable? If I was at a protest, I'd get myself tested before I went to visit my grandma in a nursing home.
What do people do when the Trump administration doesn't seem to be talking about the pandemic? We have no one telling the public really where things stand and what to do and acting as if it's just sort of like magically disappeared. And I think that's left a lot of confusion for people that aren't necessarily in those protests, but just going about their lives or not knowing if they should go about their lives.
Well, sadly, the White House has given up on the pandemic because it's all bad news for the White House. Since they didn't manage it properly, it was worse than it should have been. It's hard to run around reminding people that there are over 100,000 deaths in the U.S., and the president doesn't want to do it. He wants to talk about restoring the economy. He's sent all of his scientists and public health people into some sort of bizarre exile. I haven't seen any of them. You can't forget about the pandemic. You just can't. Politicians may have their reasons to want to forget about it, but scientists should not. I have to turn also to the governors in the U.S. to keep the message going. I saw Andrew Cuomo in New York issued a statement about the pandemic and good behavior at demonstrations in terms of public health, so they're helpful. The other group that I blame is the media. The media has switched stories and also forgotten about the pandemic. It's just a hotter story, more visuals, people marching up and down. You're not talking about some abstract danger or something that's harder to cover, and also that people are sick of, literally sick from, but sick of discussing. And I blame them for giving up on the pandemic story, too.
Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. The confirmed global death toll from the COVID-19 virus has reached at least 400,000 fatalities as of Sunday. The U.S. led the world with nearly 110,000 confirmed virus-related deaths. About 1,000 Americans a day are dying on average so far in June, but that's down from the peak of 2,000 a day in April. The first of three European Union flights headed to the Democratic Republic of Congo Sunday as part of an initiative to help prop up the country's struggling health system amid conflict and concerns of a potential uptick in coronavirus cases. Joining us with an update is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, you've been following this. It's a very large amount of assistance from the European Union, which has been very concerned about African nations.
Sunday evening from Brussels Airport, the first of what will be three humanitarian air bridge flights took off on board 40 million euros worth of aid that will go out to the DRC. On board those flights, water purifiers, nutrition support, general medical supplies, as well as other equipment such as laboratory equipment, masks, gloves, personal protective equipment that the EU is sending out there because it realizes, particularly countries like DRC, need help strengthening their health systems, they need help to support their economies. And this particular flight, this first flight on board the Belgian and the French foreign minister and the European Union commissioner in charge of crisis management, they're on board. Before they took off, they said, you know, that the humanitarian needs in the DRC are among the highest in the world. And they said that because they realized that the DRC is still continuing to grapple with Ebola. And they feel that the DRC really does need this help that's coming now.
Are they concerned that there could potentially be more COVID cases than they are actually aware of due to lack of testing?
They are indeed. I mean, when you look at how much funding the European Union is putting into not just for helping systems there, but also for tracing, tracking, actually trying to find out what's going there. These are enormous sums. Just look at it. 3.25 billion in grants to African countries, another 1.4 billion in loans. So they do realize that these are countries that are going to suffer and that really could have, you know, the fight against the coronavirus pandemic could really be very serious, and that these countries do not have the infrastructure to be able to deal with it if there is the sort of outbreak that we've seen in Europe.
And are they also sort of doing this to fill a void in any sort of world leadership role right now as far as assisting these nations?
The European Union really does feel it needs to help Africa. A lot of that is because, think back a couple of years when we had the migrants coming into Europe by boat, they realized they do have to stem that flow of migrants, that if they don't go and help Africa, then Africa will come to Europe. Also, they realize it really is in their interest, security-wise, to be helping these countries. So at the moment, it does feel to them as though the European Union, this whole humanitarian assistance that they're giving, particularly to Africa, is so needed because there are so many other countries that used to be there that aren't doing things. But also, they do realize that China is involved on the ground there, and Europe feels it has to keep their presence on the ground.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Australia is disputing Chinese government advice given to Chinese citizens, urging them not to travel to Australia because of what Beijing calls a surge in racism during the coronavirus pandemic. The Chinese Ministry of Culture and Tourism issued the warning, insisting there was a significant increase in racist attacks on Chinese and Asian people in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
China is Australia's biggest trading partner. But there is friction in the relationship. Australia's recent call for an international investigation into COVID-19, which is widely thought to have originated in Wuhan, China, infuriated Beijing. Despite denials on both sides, bans and tariffs imposed on Australian agricultural products were seen by analysts as retaliation by China. There was also criticism of Australia's early February decision to ban travellers from mainland China because of concerns over the spread of the virus. Australia has since closed its borders to all foreign nationals. In a further worsening of bilateral ties, authorities in Beijing are urging Chinese tourists not to travel to Australia because of fears of racism over the coronavirus, citing an alarming increase in violence against Asian people. This is strongly denied by officials in Canberra. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack.
It's a rather moot point because at the moment there are no travelling happening between China and Australia. But let me say this, Australia is a very welcoming country and we're certainly mindful of the fact that we've got $149.7 billion trade with China. We are very mindful that we need to exercise respect. Anybody from China who is in Australia is most welcome to be here.
However, anecdotal evidence has suggested that Chinese Australians and other Asian migrants have suffered racism because of the pandemic. Some have said they faced increased hostility both online and in shops since the outbreak began. Cell phone videos appear to support some of the allegations. A young Asian boy was reportedly bullied at school in Australia by other students who demanded he be tested for the virus. A Chinese family in Melbourne says their home was targeted by racists three times in a week. Canberra's relationship with China was already tense even before COVID-19 because of allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic affairs and cyber espionage. Australia won't want to see the situation get any worse. Australia's income from tourism and education has relied heavily on demand from China. Official advice urging Chinese citizens to avoid travel to Australia could inflict more damage on two sectors already damaged by the pandemic. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Dozens of Malian migrants stranded for nearly 3 months in Niger by COVID-19 related border closures have returned home. Earlier this week, the International Organization for Migration was finally able to repatriate 179 migrants who had been waiting at IOM transit centers. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In the past 2 weeks, the UN Migration Agency was able to return 43 migrants to Burkina Faso and 58 migrants to Benin from Niger by land. However, the return of the Malian nationals was the first by air, since restrictions on air travel were imposed to limit the spread of COVID-19. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says the airlift was made possible by an agreement between Niger and Mali.
An additional 1,400 migrants from several mainly West African countries remain in six IOM transit centers and quarantine sites in Niger, waiting for travel restrictions to lift so that they too can return to their countries of origin.
IOM agrees extraordinary measures taken by governments to curb the spread of COVID-19 may be necessary. However, it says they are having a serious impact on many vulnerable migrants. It notes many migrants stranded in foreign countries by travel restrictions cannot work, making them vulnerable to exploitation, including trafficking. The agency reports around 30,000 migrants are stranded in West and Central Africa. Dillon says more than half are foreigners, unable to cross borders to return home. Among them, he says, are Mauritanian herders who need to cross into neighboring countries to graze their cattle.
The establishment of humanitarian corridors is essential to ensure that people are able to cross international borders in a timely and dignified manner, with their rights respected and public health issues addressed. IOM stands ready to help governments increase disease surveillance at their borders, train and equip border officials, and assist with quarantine measures for those who return.
IOM reports tens of thousands of migrants are stranded across the Americas, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. It says it is providing many with financial support, food, clothing, shelter, and other essential relief. However, the agency says it is limited in what it can do. It urges governments to assist and protect migrants who are stranded on their territory and find themselves in dire straits. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The South African government has come to an agreement on financial assistance for private hospitals and medical practitioners in the country to treat severely ill COVID-19 patients if public hospitals run out of space. The government has been in talks for months with private firms and medical associates ahead of a probable scenario where public hospitals run out of critical care beds. Pope Francis on Sunday warned Italians to not let their guard down against coronavirus now that infection rates have fallen, and he urged them to obey government rules on social distancing and wearing masks. Francis addressed several hundred people in St. Peter's Square for the Sunday blessing, where he said their presence, while smaller than prior to the coronavirus outbreak, was a good sign that Italy had overcome the worst of the pandemic. The Kyoto News Agency on Sunday reported that Japan is declining to join the United States, Britain, and others in issuing a statement condemning China for imposing a new security law in Hong Kong that they said would threaten freedom and breach a 1984 agreement on the autonomy of the former colony. After George Floyd's death in police custody in Minneapolis, Minnesota, some police officers around the U.S. knelt in solidarity with protesters condemning racism. VOA's Veronica Belderas Iglesias met with the sheriff and protest organizers in Prince William County, Virginia, where taking a knee may spearhead permanent change. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Oh.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Today is World Oceans Day, and in the midst of a global pandemic and turmoil in many parts of the planet, environmental organizations are reflecting on the importance of healthy and abundant oceans. Joining us to talk about it is Jackie Savitz, Chief Policy Officer with the ocean protection organization, Oceana. I know you have a very hopeful message, and we can all certainly use that. But first, tell us about some of the issues and concerns you have currently about the world's oceans.
Well, we're very concerned about issues like plastics in the oceans. We're concerned about overfishing. We're concerned about things like offshore drilling. And each of them is a big problem in their own right. For example, when you look at plastics, 17 billion pounds of plastics get into our oceans every year with a B, 17 billion, which is the equivalent of a dump truck every minute getting into the oceans. And that's only expected to increase because there's a projected massive increase in the amount of plastics being produced. And so that's a big problem that we're very concerned about. We're also concerned about overfishing. We saw President Trump rolled back protections for an area off the coast of New England, claiming he was helping the lobstermen, even though it's not an area where they catch lobster. So it's really not clear why that happened, but these are really important habitats. They're nursery areas and spawning areas for fish. And we need to be moving forward and protecting them further, not protecting them less. So that's a big concern. And offshore drilling is an area that has become a real concern. Actually, the protections for the Atlantic and Pacific coast for drilling were lifted by George W. Bush back in 2008. But this is where I get a little bit of hope, because this is an area where we had no support to stop offshore drilling in 2008, because it really wasn't an issue then. But we were able to build up that support to the point where we now have, I think, 360 towns along the Atlantic and Pacific coast that have actively resolved against offshore drilling. We've now got Republican and Democrat members of Congress and senators opposing offshore drilling, to the point where now every governor on the Atlantic and Pacific coast, not counting Alaska, opposes offshore drilling. Mm-hmm. And that has allowed us to push back against the Trump administration, who's been in office now for more than 3 years and hasn't been able to move forward on a drilling plan because of that opposition. And the fact that we were able to do that in a bipartisan way is what really gives me hope that we can tackle some of these other issues as well.
Is there a way to determine at this point on World Oceans Day what the state of our oceans is, or is it varied? And does that hope include the health of our oceans going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's varied. When we look at fisheries, for instance, we can see that most of the fisheries that we rely on happen within the economic zones of countries. And some countries have done a good job in managing those fisheries, others not so much. But what we've found is that countries that have managed their fisheries, that have built science into the decision making, that have protected habitats like the one off the coast of New England, they start to see the fisheries come back. And there's good science and good data that shows that that method of sustainable fishery management works. So we need to, you know, look to do that in other countries. But we can look country by country, see some progress, and that's very hopeful as well. Although we also see instances where we're not seeing progress and we need to do better. And so there's still a lot of work to do going forward.
Jackie Savitz, Chief Policy Officer with the nonprofit ocean protection organization, Oceana. Thanks for being with us. And finally today, South Korean boy band BTS has donated $1 million to Black Lives Matter. The 7-member K-pop group tweeted last week in support of the protests, saying they stand against racism and discrimination. And the tweet went viral, sparking a wave of donations under the hashtag #MatchAMillion, which encouraged BTS's millions of fans to match the band's $1 million donation. BTS canceled its planned world tour in April amid the global lockdowns. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care and be well.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all these skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Anybody, anybody, anybody. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and...